For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, the big story this week comes from the Sigma Alpha Epsilon house at OU, which got kicked off campus after a racist video went viral. Neva, your thoughts on this story?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a sad, horrible situation. And I think it really goes to show that 10 seconds going viral on the Internet, what the ramifications can be for individuals, for the university, for the state. And it is regrettable. And of course, as we know, that there are many questions still that will continue to unfold in terms of not only as a result of the expelling of the two students already, but many other questions that will linger. So, I mean, we could go on and on, but, you know, I would just say that, you know, I join the literally hundreds of thousands of Oklahomans who regret that this had to be the national headline this week.
Ryan, you have always been a defender of free speech. Did the expulsion of SAE members go against the First Amendment?
You know, I think that as a state-run institution of higher education, the University of Oklahoma has to respect the First Amendment principles that are central to the mission of every university. Any sanction imposed, these students has to be consistent with the First Amendment and not merely just a punishment for this vile and reprehensible speech. And courts have consistently ruled that way, and rightfully so. And I think absent any information at our disposal at this point, it's difficult to see how a court would uphold the university's actions. That said, I think that it's important for us to realize, and I attended a town hall meeting last night, a diversity town hall meeting last night, and it was incredibly powerful. You hear from students and faculty about the myriad of issues facing minority students at the University of Oklahoma campus. You recognize the history at the University of Oklahoma. It was 66 years ago that we had to fight in the Supreme Court two times to get an African American admitted to the College of Law. Even then, she was still segregated from her white students. And we know that that history isn't over. And so what this is a reminder of is that this is more than just one chant, one racist chant. It's more than one racist video. It's a much bigger problem. And the announcement of the new vice president of diversity and community is a huge first step. But this ongoing conversation is really where we need to focus our attention.
And I think when we look at this, we have to look at it not only as an incident to be kind of dispatched, but one that needs to be really, I think you're right, Ryan, it needs to be addressed. And, you know, one of the comments that I read that I thought really said an awful lot and made you want to stop and think, is that this incident perpetuated our society's Hunger Games mentality, which basically is total annihilation. In other words, blame them, shame them, and erase them. And that's not where we're at. I mean, this is an ongoing. This is an ongoing conversation, and it's not something that can just be swept under the rug because people are uncomfortable thinking about it and conversing about it, but there have to be some real long-term solutions. So I think it's incumbent upon not just the university campuses, but across the board for us to be very serious in the dialogue and not just hope it goes away from the headlines.
And many of the students last night at this town hall meeting were saying just that we have to put ourselves in these uncomfortable situations, that as awful as this situation is and as awful as what it exposed was and is, there is a teaching and a learning moment here. And it goes well beyond just this one incident, and it has to continue even beyond the college campuses. And we have to be willing to have very difficult conversations. And the university and the people of Oklahoma have to realize we have to protect individuals from hostile environments and preserve a productive learning environment.
Right, because
on the campus.
If all that's learned out of this is that racism must never be articulated, that it must be hidden, then we've done nothing to really deal with the really root cause of the problem.
There was a faculty member last night who stood up, and she was a minority faculty member she might have been a staff member. I forget her exact position, but she stood up and she said that she had been on the campus for a long time and hadn't experienced any of the issues. This was a 3+ hour meeting last night, tearful meeting with very great and brave testimony. And she said, I wasn't aware of a lot of this, and it was very eye-opening to her. And so I think that that's the kind of dialogue that's necessary as we move forward here.
Yeah. A federal judge dismisses a lawsuit against the Ten Commandments monument at the state capitol. The ruling still allows for plaintiffs to file another suit, but AG Scott Pruitt is calling it a win for Oklahoma. Ryan, what happened here?
Yeah, so there are two different legal challenges going on. One in state courts that the ACLU of Oklahoma and our allies are bringing under the state constitution. This was a separate challenge brought in federal courts under the First Amendment. I think it's important to remember that the federal courts here never reached the substantive issue of whether or not the Ten Commandments monument on the state capitol grounds violates the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. So, you know, this was a decision. It was dismissed on the basis of standing, that these weren't the right plaintiffs to bring the challenge. And whether that's appealed or not, I think that there's a great deal of hope that we're able to succeed at the state level under the state constitution. But if not, I think that there's a real chance that there is still a federal question that remains.
Neva.
Well, I would agree with Attorney General Pruitt that this is a victory for the state of Oklahoma for affirming that the monument can remain on display. And I think as lawmakers have argued from the outset of this, it is not serving a religious purpose, but was meant to be a historical, to mark a historical event. So I think that we'll continue to see this move through the courts. I think in this particular case, I mean, it was pretty clear based upon what Judge Cawthron said that they did not meet any threshold in terms of what they were trying to accomplish by proving that the plaintiff had in any way been legally injured. So, you know, the suit that the ACLU and others are bringing adds to the mix these questions that continue to be discussed on the other side of the ledger. But in this instance, I think it appears that the court ruled the only way they possibly could.
But that was a procedural deal. We'll get to the substantive. Courts are going to have to wrestle with it, whether that's at state level or
right.
The federal level. Hopefully we can win at the state, and the federal courts will have some time to do other stuff.
There you go. On the national stage, both of Oklahoma senators signed a letter sent to Iran saying whatever treaty it signs with President Obama won't matter because he doesn't have support of the Senate. Neva, there's been a lot of backlash, even from fellow Republicans. Did this go too far?
Well, I don't think it did. And you had 47 Republican senators signing this letter. I mean, it was very thoughtful. And bottom line, the goal was simple, to stop Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. I think it does come following the Israeli Prime Minister's address to Congress, where he basically very bluntly warned the United States that that a deal with Iran could very well pave the way to a nuclear bomb. So I mean, I think that Senator Tom Cotton, the Republican from Arkansas, who was the lead author and signatory on the letter, our two U.S. senators following suit, I think that they have made the key points on this. And I think while there's been this avalanche of editorial comment across the country from newspapers weighing in trying to hammer on them, I think public sentiment would be to the contrary.
Ryan.
You know, I think that this was a foolish move on the part of the senators to try to interfere and derail these negotiations with Iran. The best chance that the United States of America and our allies have at preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon is through these negotiations and reaching a deal with Iran. If we don't do that, the other option, and I think the option that the Israeli Prime Minister and that many Republicans would have us undertake, would be war. Would be an outright attack or invasion and some direct armed conflict with Iran. I don't think that that's where the United States needs to be. And if we're really talking about whether or not this was the right thing to do or not, I think that it could have serious impacts on the United States' position in these talks. I hope that they don't. Now, we've heard folks go as far as to call these folks traitors or that this is somehow treason. I don't think that language is appropriate, and I don't think it's constructive. That's not what's happened here. But it is unprecedented, and I think that it was a foolish move on their part.
Well, you have to take into account that there's a big difference between a Senate-ratified treaty and an agreement between the President of the United States and Iran's Ayatollah, and that's basically what they were trying to point out, is that anything that is done in the closing stretch of President Obama's administration is not worth the paper it's written on if there isn't collaboration and isn't agreement with the United States Senate in this process. So I think that this unilateral presidency that has decided that they can bypass Congress when it makes sense and gets done what they want to get done, I think what they were doing is kind of putting the skids on that and saying, let's have a little bit of a government primer here on what the history is and what the rules should be.
But if the shoe were on the other foot, in 2006, if the Democrats had taken majority, sent send a letter to the Afghanistan or to Iraq or somebody saying that this that they don't support their Republican president. I mean, everybody would have gone insane on that.
Well, I think, I mean, again, this is the give and take of the process. And, you know, what we have here is a very united group of senators. I believe there were only seven Republican senators that didn't sign on to the letter. And it's less about the partisanship than I think it is really them addressing the real significant issues of foreign policy. So, you know, it's easy to kind of saddle it down with just making it partisan bickering, but I think we're talking about a much bigger issue and a much larger question.
And I think it's disingenuous, though, for Senate Republicans to say that this was just trying to educate the diplomats, and in particular the Iranian diplomats there in Switzerland involved in these negotiations, about America's constitutional process. I think that the diplomats that are there, whether we agree with them or not, on a large number of global issues, are fairly well educated about what the American negotiators are able to offer and what they aren't. So really what this was is an intervention in those negotiations in a way that's unproductive to the United States' overall interest.
But to say that this letter was unprecedented, undiplomatic. I mean, all of the phrases that have been used, that it was a propaganda ploy. I mean, it really, that's disingenuous when you think about the fact that if we have a significant number of United States senators that want to issue a letter on any particular issue and that shouldn't have some validity, it shouldn't have some reason to be seriously looked at and thoughtfully debated. I mean, we've got a big problem, and it's a lot bigger than just this one issue with Iran.
Then they need to come out and say, we're done with the negotiations, and we're gonna restart. And I don't think that I think that would be a very poor position to put the United States in, because I think then our only other options other than these negotiations are war, and that's not something that I think a majority
I don't think anyone is wanting it to move that direction at all. I think we have nuclear negotiations resuming next week in Switzerland. I think this was a timely letter to be put forward by those that had this particular point of view in the United States Senate, and I perfectly agree with both Senator Lankford and Senator Inhofe, and am pleased that they joined in being the signers on this particular letter.
State Senator Clark Jolly removes his bill to create education savings accounts in Oklahoma, and a similar bill failed in the House committee. Ryan, is this the last we'll see of so-called vouchers this year?
I think for this year. I mean, when you've got the author and the pro temp basically saying that they're willing to take a step back on this, it would be, I think it's difficult to imagine how they would come back later this session and reintroduce this proposal, either in this bill or some other bill. It's not the last we've seen of vouchers, and it's not the last we've seen at political efforts to undermine the ability of public schools to do their job. And that's exactly what this bill is. You can call it whatever you want. You can frame it however you want. You can have, you know, different mechanics of how it would play out in actuality. But at the end of the day, you're taking dollars away from public schools, and you're giving incentives and subsidies for people that can usually otherwise afford to send their children to private school to do so at a less expensive rate.
Neva.
Well, I think it's off the table this year. I think they will use the interim time to really kind of retool and rethink and move forward on this issue. I don't think it's dead by any stretch. I think there are a large number of Oklahomans who agree and want to see some fashion of the of these particular type of education savings accounts, vouchers, whatever terminology. And I think what Senator Jolly was saying is, look, what we've got, hold on, is a lot of misinformation, a lot of escalating frenzy out there, and we need to step back. We need to kind of rethink this in terms of how we're going to construct the debate so that there can be some intelligent give and take. And you know, and there is disagreement. I mean, there are many people that would disagree with what Ryan has said, that public schools would actually see an increase in the per pupil revenue as a result of the plan. There are other states that can point to specific studies and information that would validate that in those states. So this is not, this is a clear issue, like many in education, where there's a big divide on what we need to do and how we need to do it.
Finally, the State House passes a bill to end state-issued marriage licenses in Oklahoma. Neva, I could see a lot of logistical problems with this bill. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think it's one of these bills that there's been a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusion, a lot of other issues kind of injected into it. But it's abolishing government-issued Oklahoma marriage licenses, and it was a pretty significant vote in the House, 67-24, I think. It was what happens when it moves over to the Senate, we'll see. But there were a lot of arguments injected that it would have all of these unintended consequences and trying to layer a lot of other issues on top of it to try to derail it. But really, I mean, Representative Russ, what he said was it was designed to protect county court clerk offices who have been caught kind of in the middle of this fight between the federal and state government on the legality of same-sex marriages. So, you know, I think that the role of the court clerks and how that whether this accomplishes what it's intended to do, we'll see what happens on the Senate side. Sometimes these things get a great debate, they pass in one body, as we know, and then they get to the other side, they either don't get heard or they get killed very quietly. So we'll see.
Ryan.
Yeah, I think that it's important to kind of cut through. You know, Representative Russ is saying, you know, government shouldn't be involved in marriage at all. But I think that we got to go deeper than that. And when we go deeper than that, what we really see is that this is all about the prevailing argument for marriage equality in our nation. We already have marriage equality in the state of Oklahoma under a 10th Circuit decision. We're very likely to have within the next year, based upon a Supreme Court decision, marriage equality at a national level, every state. And we see legislation like this introduced as an effort to try to grasp at straws to continue to discriminate against individuals that want to be married. And whenever you get to a point where courts are telling you, you can't do that, you can't discriminate and do so within the confines of the Constitution against one group, we see these efforts to discriminate against everybody. And this is very similar, you know, Governor Mary Fallon, and whenever she was trying to get around the Pentagon's implementation of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, in an effort to discriminate against LGBT partners or spouses of National Guard members, she discriminated against all National Guard members and their ability to apply for benefits.
But this is a classic case, though. You have a lawmaker who says, here's my bill, here's what it says, and everyone wants to give a different version of what they think it says. He said the point of his legislation really was just to take the state out of the process and leave marriage in the hands of the clergy.
But if it puts it in the hands of the clergy, anybody can become a clergy. You can go online and become a clergy. So you could actually conceivably go get a clergyman who will marry you to an animal or something.
That was not the intended issue of his particular bill. What he was saying is that marriage was historically a religious covenant first, and then the government recognized the contract second. So, I mean, it's really which part of this do you really want to come down on? I mean, I think Ryan's arguments and suggestions really are a separate piece from what this particular bill was intended to do and what he argued on the floor it was all about.
There we go. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.